shortly after getting drafted, I tore my labrum for a third time, and that ended my career. Another unfortunate thing is that I lost my dad that same month. And I lost my dad, lost my dream of playing baseball professionally, all in the same month. And so, needless to say, I was quite lost at the time. I didn't know what to do with my life, didn't know where I was going anymore, because baseball was it. I thought that was my future.
Welcome, everybody, to Documentary First, the show where we dig into the craft, the business, and the truth of filmmaking. I'm your host and a filmmaker myself, Christian Taylor. This is a show where every week we have a conversation with someone who has another piece of this filmmaking puzzle we all need to hear that will help us become better filmmakers. If you haven't yet, hit follow or subscribe wherever you're watching or listening. It's the best way to support the show. Today, I am delighted to be joined by Andrew Ganz. Andrew is here to talk about his directorial debut, Voices, the Danny Ganz story, a very personal story about the life of his very talented father, Danny Ganz. Welcome, Andrew. It's so great to have you on the show.
Hey, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
I cannot wait to get into this story. I just finished watching it. Actually, today I usually wait until the very last minute, so you get my fresh reaction from this film. I told you this offline. I had to wait to get myself together because this was a beautiful film, well told, very emotional, and there was a lot in there I could relate to. I don't want to give any of it away because I want you to share about your film. And even before we get to that, I'd like to share you to share a little bit about yourself. So I know nothing about you other than just a little bit I learned in your film. Tell me a little bit about your life, who you are, where you were born, grew up, how you ended up in filmmaking, and about who this man is. Yeah, Danny Ganz. Tell me about that.
Well, I mean, I grew up in LA, and before filmmaking even was a thought, my goal in life was to be a Major League Baseball player. And I worked day in, day out pursuing that. And as I got older, it was something that I excelled at really highly. I was fortunate enough as a senior in high school to be drafted to play professionally, but I had a hard time staying on the field due to injuries. I had, before I even graduated high school, I had torn my labrum twice and had surgeries. And shortly after getting drafted, I tore my labrum for a third time, and that ended my career. Another unfortunate thing is that I lost my dad that same month.
Breaking news, performer Danny Ganz has died.
There's a good chance you know his name or you're one of the millions who've seen his show.
Oh, and my gosh.
So I lost my dad, lost my dream of playing baseball professionally, all in the same month. And so, needless to say, I was quite lost at the time. I didn't know what to do with my life, didn't know where I was going anymore. Baseball was it. I thought that was my future. And so I turned to acting a little bit. I pursued acting. I moved back to LA from Las Vegas. And it was more so an outlet for me to kind of process a lot of this emotion and a lot of the grieving that I was experiencing.
Acting is great therapy.
Yeah. And I liked it. And I got an agent, I got a manager, booked some things, did commercials, all that stuff. But it wasn't ever something that I felt fully fulfilled doing. And so I said, like, I'm going to explore other things. And I took a screenwriting class. And it just opened my mind to a whole world of possibilities. And I just loved the idea of telling stories that way. And so I started writing, experimenting with different formats and learning how to write a script. And then I just kind of stumbled my way into producing. And one opportunity led to another, and I was able to start producing professionally. And I've produced like a dozen films now. And before I started this, I knew I wanted to direct and I knew I wanted to pursue that, but I wanted to make sure I was ready. And I had learned all the facets of making a film, and I understood, you know, how to make a film, what it takes to put a film together from development all the way through distribution. But could I do it myself? Could I execute it in a creative way? And that's when I decided at some point, like, okay, I want to take that next step. And I felt like I was ready to do it. And it felt like the right thing to do the story about my dad.
Very powerful, strong place to start. Scary place.
I was definitely jumping in the deep end.
I was about to say that exact thing. You jumped into the deep end of the pool. Going back to what you said about your dream being a baseball player and your injury and what happened with your dad at the same time, the apple does not fall from far from the tree, does it?
No, and a funny thing is that my grandfather had the same thing happen to him.
Really?
Yeah, so my dad's dad played professional baseball for a short period of time. I believe it was with the St. Louis Cardinals organization.
Oh,
and he had a career-ending injury, and then he went into singing and comedy. And he would travel around, and he performed a lot in the Catskills, like in the 40s. And that's where he met his wife, my dad's mom. She was performing. She was a singer as well. And she was performing at the theater across the street from my grandfather. And they had the night off. So they all came over to see my grandfather perform. And during the show, he walks into the audience and he spots her. Her name is Alta. He spots her out of the crowd and has her stand up, and he sings a song to her. And he introduces her to the audience as the future Mrs. Gans.
Oh my gosh, how crazy.
And, 2 weeks later, they got married.
No way.
Yeah, 2 weeks later, they got married. And then they combined their shows and they traveled together around the country for a few years. And then when they wanted to settle down, they both kind of gave up on entertainment and tried to kind of raise a family and live a normal life.
What an incredible story. And then your grandfather, as I learned in the film, decided he wanted to live his dreams through your father in terms mm-hmm. of playing baseball. And your father then was drafted by which team?
The White Sox.
The White Sox.
Yeah, I was drafted by the White Sox. And, you know, he had a terrible injury. He severed his Achilles tendon. He was playing first base and the runner stepped on his heel and it severed his Achilles tendon. And that was the end of his career. And it was devastating for him. I think he battled that for quite a while, but he had this ability to do voices and comedy and sing and make people laugh.
Little girl with your red dress, y'all. Shake a bird land all night long. Oh, yeah.
Production.
And so he pivoted really hard into that and just put all that time and energy and dedication that he had towards athletics. He applied that towards this new career path and he took off.
Yeah, apparently he did. Man, where he ended up was just amazing. And we'll get there in a little bit. What I thought about when you got to the part where your father, incurred that injury is if that had happened today. Now, what year was that when he incurred that injury? That would have been in the 70s, right?
Yeah.
If that had happened today, that would have been put back together and he would have been put back in the game. But not.
Yeah, I think that would have been an injury that's like, okay, you're out for 9 months to a year.
Yeah. I mean, they can do that with Tommy John now. It's, 18 months and they're back in. But yeah, but back then it's, career ending, like you said. And I mean, you were still playing after 3 labrum tears, right?
Yeah. The first two I got repaired and, I was doing physical therapy for like 2 years straight. But even now it's even better than when I was getting my operations done. That was 15 years ago.
Well, I do hope that your family has now learned the lesson that you guys are not meant to be in baseball, that you are meant to be in entertainment.
Well,
somehow,
I mean, the work ethic that we learned from it has definitely helped us. And
for sure.
I definitely want my kids to play sports and athletics and support them in whatever dreams that they have.
Yes, that's true.
I think playing sports definitely builds a foundation of mental toughness and work ethic that is hard to get anywhere else.
Agreed. And I think it also builds teamwork and camaraderie that in any, you know, anywhere in life you need, especially in the entertainment world, that teamwork, you know, skill is incredibly necessary, I think. And you see that. I love in your film, it is very collaborative, particularly with your family and the other people that worked with your father. I see you including everybody in the project that you did, and that was beautiful to see. So you decided you take on this project. You're going to tell the story of your dad. Tell me the beginning of this. How did it start, and how did you map this out? You started with your producer brain, and your scriptwriter brain. Talk to me about how this started.
I always felt like my dad's story was going to make a really interesting film and that people would take a lot out of it. But it always came down to the timing, when I was going to do it, how I was going to do it. And after I had made a number of films, I felt like I was prepared. And that kind of coincided, or it may have been inspired by a little bit, the 10th anniversary of my dad's death.
Breaking news, performer Danny Gans has died.
There's a good chance you know his name, or you're one of the millions who've seen his show.
I got together with my family. We get together, we try to get together every year on his birthday and the anniversary of his passing to have dinner and just kind of be together. And on that 10th anniversary, I was just looking back into his life and the years that have passed since his death. And I felt like the city of Las Vegas specifically had moved on and didn't recognize him, didn't kind of commemorate his achievements in a way that I felt he deserved. And I wanted to do something about that. And I felt, instead of, you know, reaching out to the city of Las Vegas and saying, hey, you should put a name a street after my dad or give him a statue or something, that's a long process. That's out of my control. That's a big hill to climb. So what I could do is make a film. And so I just started doing that. I kind of mapped out how I wanted the visual style to be. And I dug deep into like the archives that we have, what show performances we had. And we had a plethora from probably 30 years of him performing. And then so I just asked my mom to sit down for an interview, and she was the first one. I used that interview and I spliced it together and I edited a teaser basically. And I used that teaser to go raise some money. And then we really started production and we went to Vegas. Our first trip to Vegas, we got like 10 interviews, 12 interviews. We got a bunch of B-roll. We were rocking and rolling. Everything was moving smoothly. And then COVID hit.
Of course.
Yes.
Naturally.
And COVID hit. We had only had those 12 interviews. We only had a little bit of B-roll and we had all this show performance. So we didn't have enough to start editing. So we had to shut down for over a year. And that really took the wind out of our sails. A lot of the investors ended up backing out.
Ugh.
And I had to rebuild the whole thing.
And on this depressing note, we're going to take a moment and we're going to watch your trailer because you actually pulled it together. You pulled off this amazing movie. And I want to take a minute and have people watch if they're watching or listen if they're only listening. I want people to hear your dad's performance. He was an incredible, amazing performer. And what I learned from your film was that he was the first $100 a ticket performer in Las Vegas. Is that right?
Yes, that is correct.
Before Sammy Davis Jr. or Frank Sinatra or anyone else, his ticket went for $100. And for 6 years in a row, he sold out every night and you had to stand in line and hope somebody didn't show up to get a seat, right?
Mm-hmm. That's all true.
Yeah. Crazy, crazy good. So, all right. Without further ado, here's the trailer for Voices, Danny Gann's story.
He's known as the most successful comic you've never heard of.
He had a totally different act than anybody that had come along for quite a while.
There will never be a likes of Danny Gann's in Las Vegas again.
He is the man of many voices! Danny Gann!
Little girl with your red dress, y'all. Shake a bird laying on that log. Go ahead.
A man, a woman.
protection.
People were talking about greatest impressionists ever, like they had just seen God.
Dirty. Standing ovations every night, Dirty. Sold out night after night after night.
The best entertainer I ever saw.
We have some outstanding talent to talk to you about the star of our show.
I can still remember the seat I sat in, and I watched him perform, and I sat there just in awe.
I was transformed. As an audience member, I was mesmerized.
Everybody from Katharine Hepburn to Pee Wee Herman.
His career just kept moving upward and upward and upward. I kept feeling like it's never going to end.
Breaking news, performer Danny Gans has died.
There's a good chance you know his name or you're one of the millions who've seen his show.
Have you done a lot of documentaries?
No, this is my first.
Right. And you do it about your dad. Mm-hmm. It's very brave of you.
I love you. There's his whole life in here. I would say making this film is my version of having a few more years with him. My goal is that through this, my family and I can find some closure with what happened to my dad.
The truth is always gonna cost you. What do I want to show people about my father? He would want you to struggle with that.
Can I have that voice double now? Because I've lost mine.
Obviously, he was suffering.
Did he ever open up to you about those types of things and his health?
He held those cards close to his chest.
It's very possible that he went out there when he shouldn't have. I know I have.
He was heading for the stars, no question.
People say I was made for this. Nothing else but I trade for this. I thank God because I prayed for this.
Thank you and good night.
And now, a word from our sponsor.
Today's episode is brought to you by our friends over at Virgil Films. With over 25 years of distribution experience, Virgil has released such hits as Super Size Me and the Oscar-nominated Restrepo, along with a trove of indie treasures like Forks Over Knives, To Die For, 7 Yards, and Speed is Expensive. Now, you can find all of those films, along with the entire Virgil catalog, on any transactional platform out there like Amazon, Apple TV, YouTube, Tubi, and the rest. Are you a filmmaker and you're having trouble with distribution? Talk to Virgil. They work with every major platform directly, and they offer a variety of deals that fit with every filmmaker's needs, from standard distribution to service deals. They do it all. And they don't just distribute films. They elevate them. Truthfully, they're just really good people to work with. So if you want to learn more, head on over to virgilfilms.com. And tell them Christian Taylor sent you. And now, on with the show.
All right, after our little commercial break, we're back. Andrew, that's amazing. Love your trailer as well. Nicely done. Tell us, how did you pull out of that depressing post-COVID problem?
Well, honestly, I really didn't have a choice. If I was gonna finish the film and finish what I started, I just had to find a way. So I started piecing together the money that I had available to me, and I reached out to friends who I had met in the industry that would come out and help shoot, whether it was like a DP or, you know, someone just, you know, camera operating or holding the boom. It didn't matter. We had to keep going. We had to keep moving forward. And slowly but surely, things started to progress. And then we found some investors that helped us finish the film and do everything that we needed to do. And it ended up becoming really good that we had to take that break because of what happened later on during the filming, which is as I was making this film about my dad, became a dad myself.
Yes.
And if we hadn't had those setbacks, we wouldn't have been able to capture that during the filming of the movie. And that became something that was kind of baked into the film and part of my journey that was very kind of transcendent to just what making a film is. Something I couldn't have ever expected that. And it was very special to be able to share that and have that be part of this, because as much as I wanted to honor my dad, I know that my children we'll never get a chance to meet him. And this is something that I know I can make and create and control and share with them down the road. And they can see that I was at a point in my life where I was building a family, growing a family, getting married, having children. And I was doing this for my father while I was starting to really get traction in my career and just share this really special time with them when they're older and able to really understand and appreciate it.
Yeah, that was a beautiful part of your film. And it actually leads me right into the next question I wanted to ask you, which is, you know, about the storytelling decision making, because you actually wrestle with it in the film. And I found it to be very interesting how you decided to actually be in the film. You shared this part in your story that you and your wife were in the film together, sharing the fact that you were pregnant and expecting your child. And you also, in the film, had another camera while you were shooting whoever you were interviewing and asking the questions. You also had the camera on you. You allowed yourself to be part of the story as well. So when did you make that decision? Did you make that decision always from the very beginning? You thought, okay, I am going to be part of this story, or did that evolve as the story went along? Tell me about that decision-making process.
That evolved for sure. When I first set out to make the film, I wanted to tell my dad's life story and share this inspirational story, underdog, reinventing himself, going from baseball to entertainment. I thought that was all very interesting, and I wanted to honor his life and his accomplishments. But once I got started, I realized I was in for a lot more than that, and it was a very emotional experience for me. I was learning things I didn't know I wasn't really prepared for either. And I felt I'd be doing the film a disservice if I didn't include that. And I'd be, you know, withholding things from the audience that might be able to help them or make them feel like, you know, less alone in some of their struggles or their grieving if they've lost someone or have had to reinvent themselves going from pursuing one dream and having to start over. So I felt like, as challenging as it was for me to be that vulnerable while also managing the film as a director and a producer, and then it being about my dad, it was all very overwhelming at times, all consuming for sure, but I felt like it was well worth it. And it definitely made me a stronger person, stronger filmmaker, better father. And I'm just like very grateful for the whole experience.
I really loved how you structured the film. And really, I feel like there was a lot of luck in it as well because of things like Louis Anderson, one of the comedians that you ended up interviewing. You must have interviewed him pretty early on because he did pass away in 2022. So he was probably one of your earlier interviews, I suppose. But he said to you early on, you can either tell a story the easy way or the hard way, is basically what he said. And he encouraged you to do things the hard way, you know, or challenge yourself, right? And my guess is that was long before you encountered some of the challenges that you, in terms of the truths that you uncovered about your father as you went along, or the things that you learned, or the decisions that you had to make. Is that true?
Yeah, it is true. And I took what Louis said to heart because I was wrestling with a lot of things at the time. I had anticipated some tough things to come up, and I was really reluctant to get in front of the camera and do that. But that interview specifically, and then talking with my wife and my mom and sisters about the whole direction of the film, I felt confident that it was the right choice to make. But yeah, the interview with Louis, it was on that first trip before COVID. And the
brilliant advice.
Yeah. He's a great interview. And we went back to him several times during the edit, and we've leaned on a lot of the things that he said pretty heavily. He's a big part of the film, and very grateful for how vulnerable and honest he was in his interview. He was a very, very sweet guy.
Yeah, he really was. He was a great interview. And what I thought was interesting is I loved how you showed your own struggle. You were very vulnerable about your struggle in your decision-making as a director. You know, I don't know if I want to include these pieces about my dad. I don't know if I should or not.
The truth is always going to cost you. What do I want to show people about my father? He would want you to struggle with that.
Can I have that voice double now? Because I've lost mine.
And it shows as documentary filmmakers the truth about what happens in documentary filmmaking. I don't know how many times I've heard this. You set out as a documentary filmmaker to think you're going to tell one story and what it's going to look like. And inevitably, it turns out to be something completely different once it's finally told. And it sounds like you did have one idea how you wanted to tell this story about your father. But in telling that, you found all these other facets of ways that you could help other people or things that you might be able to shine a light on and make the story more interesting. And one of the things that I thought you placed perfectly, I mean, it looks like it was designed for your film, was the speech that your father gave on stage, the Charlie has taken the right path speech.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was
most beautiful pieces of editing I have ever seen. It was placed absolutely perfectly with what you were, you know, talking about in the moment. What was he quoting from? What was that?
That was from Scent of a Woman.
Oh, he did that so well, but boy, did you put it in the right place.
Yeah, that was something that I had thought about for a while. I said, that's just, it mirrors that very well, thematically and tonally. And so I wanted to try to find a way to edit that piece together. And it really came out well. And when I decided that I was going to be in the film more, I knew that I had to create this through line for that pursuit. What am I doing? Why am I doing this? Why is it important to me? And then how things change over the course of making the film, how I change over the course of making the film, and not just, here's the story of Danny Gantz. And so those two things were kind of going back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, until like the midpoint when they really converge and become one. And then it's just, it kind of becomes a tale of two films. Like you have a first half that is very much your prototypical biographical documentary with the added layer of me being in it as the son and the director, and you follow my path. But the second half becomes something much different.
Right, right. And what we're talking about here is, you know, this speech, Charlie has taken the right path from A Scent of the Woman, is basically his father giving this speech on stage as a character. Al Pacino is the actor, so he's imitating him in his a perfect imitation about, you know, Charlie making this decision. You know, is he going to take the right path or the wrong path? Charlie takes the wrong path. He takes the right path, and he takes the wrong path, I think, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very poetic in a lot of ways. And I think I just leaned on it because I felt I was very hesitant to make this decision. But deep down, I felt like it was the right thing to do, to include all of my dad's struggles, to put myself in there, to really include my family.
I love you. There's his whole life in here.
I would say making this film is my version of having a few more years with him. My goal is that through this, my family and I can find some closure with what happened to my dad.
And I felt like at the end of the day, when I really just decided, yes, I'm going to do it, I'm going to put it all in there, I felt a tremendous sense of peace. Like I'd finally kind of, I'd been wrestling with it for so long. It created so much anxiety and conflict within myself that, you know, I'd lay awake at night, just tossing and turning, really struggling with this. But I felt like my dad would not want that. That's what he wouldn't want. And if I was struggling with it that much, you know, he would not want me to feel burdened with his struggles or his, you know, things that he may have wanted to keep secret in his life when he was alive. But in death, I think he can help a lot of people by sharing his struggles because, you know, it opens up this whole new dialogue of what he was going through and how at the time that was being treated, and that he was not like one of one. He was one of millions of people that were in a lot of pain chronically and were seeking treatment and were being led down this path that was just very, very dangerous.
Yeah. Do you think that your reticence to include this truth, include yourself, include your family, is this young boy that wants to idolize his dad and wants everyone to see how wonderful his dad is and wants everyone to know that man and not see the bad parts? And so, you know, you wanted to tell that side and you didn't want to diminish, you know, or tarnish, you know, his, is that the struggle you were wrestling with? And then ultimately you came to grips with what you were saying. And so you chose, you know, that path. Was that the struggle?
That is definitely it. The struggle of wanting to protect him.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that there's a very slippery slope and it's very easily misconstrued. It's very easy for someone to just take a headline and twist it and turn it into something that it's really not. And I wanted to protect him from that. And yeah, of course, I want to hold on to the image that I had of him as a young boy who looked up to him and saw him as this hero figure. But I think he's more of a hero when you realize that he's human and that he has flaws and that he lived his life the right way. His work ethic, his dedication to his family and his faith were all, you know, what made him him. It wasn't just doing voices. And I think the sad part is that I think I know that now more than he did when he was alive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well.
And I just wish they had the opportunity to kind of take a step back, take some time off to really look at that and see that the version of him that's on stage is just one part.
Yeah, I hope you do have peace now after so many people have watched your film. I'm sure that they feel like I feel after I have watched it, which is I have an incredible amount of respect for your father and wish desperately that I would have gotten to see him perform and would have been able to meet him, because he just seems like an incredible person. And I got to know his family through your film and he just can see the legacy that he's left behind through the family that he helped raise. That's no small feat in itself. That's the beautiful work that he did and with your mom and putting together your family. And, you know, I struggle with chronic pain myself. And that is a horrible, horrible thing to have to deal with. And yet he was able to do the things he did in spite of all of that, which gives me even more respect for him and what he did. So that, I think that's got to be true for other people that watch your film as well. So I hope that does give you some comfort that the choice that you made, I think, was a wise one. And it does give people compassion. It gave me incredible compassion for him. And it broke my heart because I think in so many ways, the medical community let your dad down, you know?
Yeah. That's what I want people to walk away from this film feeling is I want them to be thoroughly entertained from beginning to end. And if I can see you on a ride, I wanted the feeling of watching the film to be like the feeling of sitting in the theater watching him perform.
People say I was made for this. Nothing else but I trade for this. I thank God because I prayed for this.
Thank you and good night.
I wanted to make you laugh. I wanted to make you cry. I wanted to make you think. And I really wanted you to leave feeling like you got this emotional exercise like you were in a really tough workout and you got in there and you laughed, you cried, you felt all the things. And
I did.
Good. I did
wonder if there was anywhere where I could watch a performance, because I really do want to watch a whole performance now, or more than one.
You will.
Good. That's
not
awesome.
Yet, but you will.
I can't wait to hear more. That's great.
Yes, we'll have to do another one.
Excellent. All right. Well, tell me some filmmaking things that you learned. What can you share with our audience that, you know, through making of this film, lessons that you have learned as a first-time filmmaker, things that you would do differently or things that you didn't know?
That's a long list. I think one of the things that held me back at first was feeling like I had to be 100% prepared, because I don't think you ever really are, especially when you're making
a kid, isn't it? You're never really ready to have a kid. You want to be, but you know, there's no manual.
Yeah, I think that was part of it for me, because I'm very much like, I want to be in control. I want to know all the different variables, and you can only prepare to a certain extent. And then you have to just let it go and let things happen and make decisions in the moment and trust that you know your story well enough to pivot and make decisions in real time. And that's the same with narrative filmmaking or a scripted filmmaking. But in documentary, I think it's even more so, because so many things change on a daily basis. And I'll be in an interview, like with Louis Anderson, for example. I had probably 45 questions and I got through the first 12 or 15. And then he and I just started having a conversation, and I didn't ask any of my questions after that. I had them in my head and I made sure I got a few more in, but the interview took on a life of its own. And it went from me feeding him questions to get things that I wanted answered to him. He just like took over and it took on a life of its own.
He gave you advice, right? He was like telling you life advice.
Yeah, he was giving me life advice. He was telling me stories about my dad I'd never heard of. He was going on tangents about what it's like to work and do corporate entertainment and things that I didn't know he had experience in. So I was learning about him and how he had things in common with my dad. And if I was too rigid, I would have, you know, cut that off. I would have gone back to my notes and gone back to my list of questions. But because I allowed myself to be open, we got one of the greatest interviews in the film. And it wasn't because I was in control. It was because I allowed myself not to be in control.
What a great piece of advice. That is a great point. That's beautiful.
Something else. I think this isn't really something I learned, like I made a mistake or anything like that, but I had never been able to be so close to the post-production process. I obviously knew everything that went into it, but to be the one that's making all the decisions and sitting down with my editor and working with her through all the different scenes, through all the different outlines that I would create, and I would be, you know, writing and rewriting how I wanted something to be edited and how I wanted this impression to kind of overlap with this beat in the film. And I wanted these to mirror thematically or tonally, and being able to really fine tune all those nuances and find things that, you know, you put things together and it creates something that is greater than the sum of its parts. That is like, that's movie magic. That's where things really, really take that next step. And like you said, the Al Pacino moment with Charlie making this decision, going down that path, and me wrestling with what decision I should make. We found little nuggets like that along the way that were really special. And that whole process of editing and recreating the film, putting the film that was in my head onto, you know, this little monitor was a great experience. And I learned so much about filmmaking and storytelling in that way. And we found so many wonderful moments that we didn't know were there.
Yeah, that's beautiful. I ended up giving my editor writing credit because I feel like so much of the documentary process, the writing of a documentary happens in that edit room between the director and the editor. There is so much movie magic that happens. You can have a script written out and you can have things storyboarded out, but as you've got all those pieces of the puzzle lying there and you're talking through things together, there is some magic that takes over in that you discover things. It is beautiful. You're right.
Yeah, I was able to, the editors that I was able to work with were fantastic. Kate Hackett she was on the film first and she was incredible. And that was at a time where I think I was a little more, I would say hesitant. I didn't necessarily have as much confidence in my vision. And she really helped me feel like okay to try things that didn't work. And I really valued that. And it kind of encouraged me to come out of my shell and really get creative with the edit and with the way I wanted to tell the story. And that kind of blossomed into a lot of the ideas that are in the film now that weren't before, was just kind of the confidence that she gave me. And then when I started working with the second editor, her name's Jamie Conklin, we were just like a steamroller, just churning it out. And our first cut of the film was like 3.5 hours. And there was so many beautiful moments that we had to lose, but we were able to combine things that we didn't think would have fit together before. Once again, it became something that was very unique and better than what it was previously. So what first started out being 3.5 hours was condensed down to 1 hour and 40 minutes. And every single moment is earned.
Yeah. I also want to talk to you about the other interesting interviews you had. I haven't seen Tony Orlando since the 70s. and honestly, I haven't seen Donny Osmond since much later than that either. It was great to see them. So you had those two interesting interviews as well. Tell me about those interviews.
So they had both been performing in Vegas, Donny Osmond more prominently. Actually, my dad encouraged him and his sister Marie to take their show to Vegas.
Yeah. Didn't Donnie say that your dad had produced him? Did he say that?
Yeah, my dad produced their Vegas show.
When did he have time to do that?
Well, he would go on like his off days or before he would go to work, he would go to their rehearsals and his main thing in the production was obviously telling them, hey, you need to bring your show to Vegas. He helped them find the showroom. And they were working at the Flamingo, I believe, for a long time. But the big thing was how to structure your show.
Interesting.
And you're not going to go out there and just sing your hits because Vegas is very brutal. And these people are coming to the entertainment capital expecting to see glitz and glamour and a spectacle show. So if you treat it like a concert, it's not going to go well. And so he really helped them refine the structure and how to take the audience on a journey. And and they crushed it in Vegas. They were there for like over 15 years and were doing very well. So he and my dad were really good friends, needless to say. And so when I asked Donnie to do the interview, he jumped at the opportunity and treated me very, very well. He was so nice and thoughtful. And my dad had a charity run in Vegas that he would do every year to raise money for the Nevada Childhood Cancer Foundation. And after my dad passed, Donnie took over that charity run and kept it in my dad's name. And it was like the Danny Gans Run for Life, hosted by Donny Osmond. And that was just something very sweet of him to do. And he was a great interview as well. He opened up about the pressures of being an entertainer and how that puts a lot of pressure on you mentally and emotionally, but also it puts a lot of pressure on your family. And he had a lot of good insight on what he perceived as my dad's perfectionism and his drive. And, you know, he could relate to it in some way, but he even acknowledged that my dad had this need to be perfect or as close to perfect as can be that drove him to greatness, but also was part of his downfall at the same time.
Yeah. Which you talk about, you know, goes back to his father and kind of the pressure that he probably felt there. All right, well, tell me about Tony Orlando.
Tony was a similar situation. They were friends. He had come to see my dad's show, and my dad's manager at the time, Melanie, managed Tony previously. So that's kind of how they made the connection. I didn't know they had such a history before that and doing corporate dates together.
Okay.
And he was just like, had so many wonderful stories and great analogies and metaphors for me, and really gave me an insight on the challenges of being an entertainer and finding your path. Because a lot of times when people are, they reach the top, you don't understand or see all the struggle that mm-hmm. went into that, and all the doubt and all the fear of not making it. And you see the beautiful theaters that they play, but you didn't see the theaters that were filled with smoke and half empty and people not paying attention, or nights that they bombed, or nights that, you know, just frankly just didn't go well. But those were all stepping stones. And I think Tony Orlando, Donny Osmond, Lance Burton, the magician from Las Vegas, he also brought some really great insight into the film for the professional side of things and the responsibility that you feel for the people that work for you as well. Because if you're not getting up on stage and performing every night, they're not able to feed their families. Right. And that's a huge weight on a headliner's shoulders, is knowing that their crew and their band and the people that work in the theater are all relying on them to get up and perform.
Yeah, so much pressure. I definitely got that message at how much pressure your dad must have had on his shoulders, for sure. I also thought it was interesting that Steve Wynn, you got an interview from Steve Wynn, and I didn't realize that he passed away. I mean, that Steve Wynn had created this whole theater just for your dad, and it was only used for 11 weeks before he passed away.
Yeah. Steve Wynn owned the Mirage before my dad went there as well. So okay. He brought my dad over from the Rio, and he said, "Hey, I'll build you a theater, do whatever you want." So that's how my dad got to the Mirage. And then shortly after my dad signed there, it was like a year into his contract, Steve sold all of those hotels. I think he owned the Bellagio, the Mirage, Treasure Island, and MGM maybe, and like the Golden Nugget. He owned all five of those. He sold them all, and he...
The Encore.
He built the Wynn, and then he built Encore. And when my dad's contract was up at the Mirage, he reached out and said, "I need you. Come on over to the Encore and I'll do the same thing. I'll build you your theater and we'll just kind of break more records.
It just kills me then. It means that I could have seen your dad, because I stayed at the Wynn Hotel shortly after it was, you know, built, maybe a year after it was built or something. Your father was probably in residence there at the time.
And It could have been.
Dang it. Okay, so talk to me about what you're going to do differently in your next film. Have you thought about that? Have you thought, okay, my next film, these are the things that I've learned. This is what I'm going to do differently.
Well, I don't think my next film is going to be a documentary.
Really? Interesting.
Yeah. I've been writing some scripts, and that's been something that I've always kind of gone back to repeatedly. And it's something where I think this time around, I've found something that really spoke to me. And when I first started writing this draft, it just kind of poured out and everything's starting to click. So it just feels like the right time to make that next step into narrative, like scripted filmmaking. And I think a lot of what I learned translates just to filmmaking in general. It's just telling the truth, being as vulnerable as you can bear, and just putting all of your commitment into what you're presently doing. Because a lot of the times it's easy to get overwhelmed with how many things need to go right to make a film and to finish a film. but you can only do one thing at a time. So I tried to remind myself, I'm not making the film yet. I'm not distributing the film yet. I'm writing the film. So I need to make the best script possible. And if even that seems overwhelming, I need to make the best scene possible. And if on a bad day, that seems really hard, I need to just write one line as well as I can. And I think taking that approach into this next phase and this next leap towards narrative filmmaking is really where I think something that will help me succeed. And it's, we were talking a little bit before about, you know, putting yourself into your work, no matter what you're doing, even if it's not something that is necessarily personal. Everything has to be personal. I don't think I could write something very well if it wasn't personal, or if I didn't feel like I was putting myself in it in some way, shape, or form.
Yeah, it's true. Our art really is a reflection of us, or it should be, really.
Mm-hmm.
Good words. Let's turn now to what's next for this wonderful film. I know, personally, you're going to be going to Julian Dubuque Film Festival, which will have passed by the time we air this. So you've got a couple of film festivals left. How has your film festival run been, first of all? Where all have you shown the film?
It's been really good. I didn't really know what to expect going into it, but I've really enjoyed the ride. I've gotten the most out of it that I could. We premiered the film in LA, which is what I really wanted to have, like the world premiere in LA so that my family and friends could be there. And so we premiered with Dances with Films in LA, and we got to show the film at the Chinese Theater,
Wow, that's great.
Which was very cool. And then from there, we did the Austin Film Festival, which was a great highlight for us. We've done about 12 now, and Julian Dubuque will be one of the last ones. So after Julian Dubuque, we'll be going to San Luis Obispo for that film festival. And San Luis Obispo, the university there is called Cal Poly, and that's where my parents met. So it's right. A very fitting end for our festival run.
That's great. Wonderful. And then do you have plans for distribution next?
Yes, we have several offers for distribution, and we are narrowing in on one. Okay. So we are pushing forward there and hopefully have a deal in place here shortly. And we can hopefully be making some announcements soon.
Can't wait to hear it. That's fantastic. Awesome. All right. We have now come to everybody's favorite section of the podcast, DocuView Deja Vu. All right. Now, did you come prepared to share a documentary that you love with our audience?
Yeah, I have a couple. I have to be honest, though. I have two little kids, and I'm trying to get this film out there. I'm trying to write my next film. I don't get a chance to watch a whole lot other than Disney Plus.
Okay.
But I do have, there was one film in particular that I saw at several of the festivals that I went to.
Okay.
And it's not out yet. So I know that's kind of maybe doesn't fit into the segment.
You need to be on the lookout for it.
But it is called Shuffle. And okay. It is about the drug rehabilitation centers and how they have committed so much fraud against their patients. The people who come out and seek treatment are being defrauded by all of these organizations who are really overcharging and kind of putting people into positions that are not in their best interests. So I found that very powerful and very interesting. And I got a chance to know the filmmakers at the festivals that I've been to. And so I would definitely highly recommend that one whenever it comes out. And that's called Shuffle. But the other ones that I've watched a couple of documentaries several times. And one of them that I always enjoy going back to was Searching for Sugar Man. And
I've never seen that.
It's a really good one. It's about a musician, and I really can't like describe it without giving away like a major twist. There is a huge revelation at the midpoint, and I don't want to give it away, but it's about this musician who's almost like a poet, like Bob Dylan. And okay. He created this album that nobody thought would ever go anywhere. And then he passed away, and all of a sudden, he blows up in this country, I think in South America. And he becomes this huge artist there. And it's about this documentary filmmaker who goes there and like kind of learns about him and tells his story and the things that he learns along the way. And it's fascinating. It's very cool and very unexpected in the second half.
Can't wait to watch this one.
For Sugarman.
All right. Awesome. Thank you for that recommendation. All right. Well, it's been delightful to meet you. Loved learning about your dad and your family. Just enjoyed this film so much. Everybody, this is Voices, this Danny Gann's story. You'll be able to find it soon. We don't know where, but we will shortly. Thank you so much for your time today. And thank you, everybody, for listening to Documentary First, where we believe everybody has a story to tell, and you can be the one to tell it. Bye, everybody.